Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Benjamin Levy. We're here on site at OncLive On Air at our annual CFS event. Pleasure to be joined today by Dr. Scott Tagawa. We're going to be talking about all things GU malignancies. Full disclosure, I am not a GU oncologist. I wanted to be one in 2009, but David Nandis made certain that wouldn't be the case. So we are going to start with PSMA-positive prostate cancer. Obviously, I've sat in on your talk, Scott. A lot of notable highlights regarding the evolution of PSMA-positive prostate cancer treatment paradigm. You've been intimately involved in this story for 20, 25 years looking at this treatment strategy. How is the detection evolving, and what does the treatment paradigm look like for these patients?
So I think we may have a broad audience. So PSMA is a cell surface protein. And like other cell surface proteins, we can do immunohistochemistry and things like that. But one of the nice things is that therapy has been co-developed with imaging. So we can do a scan and look at each individual lesion, look how bright or not bright there is, and have an in vivo image of assessment of kind of a target. It tells us something about volume, tells us something about biology at the same time, and happens to now be a therapeutic target. So that's been nice that has kind of come along in this what we call theranostic paradigm, therapy and diagnostics, especially in the case of imaging. And there is some association about how homogeneously bright, not bright, or heterogeneous expression is in terms of the therapy results, particularly when we're using single agents. So I think we're moving beyond into combos, but particularly in the world of single agents that we can, you know, see what you treat kind of paradigm at least stands at least as of today.
And what are those agents? So what are we using now? What are the particular agents of interest that are being leveraged for patients who have PSMA positive prostate cancer?
So it's complicated. So there's the first main generic agent out there is called PSMA-11. It's labeled with gallium-68. And there's several different FDA-approved versions, including a company that has a couple of versions of that. But that's the most common. It's the first one that was FDA approved, UCSF and UCLA, and has been out there in the world for the longest. There's also DCPUL with another version that's coming out. It's I don't want to get into pass-through, but it's expanded access plus a way to also have it reimbursed. And then PSMA 7.3, which is another F-18 agent, and more to come. I think they're, in my mind, in the clinic, much more similar than they are different. And I would say use of any one of them is clearly better than none of them. I do have a preference if someone's getting a second or a third to try and stick with the same, but they're all similar. There may be a new one coming that may be a little bit different. It's a BIS PSMA, it's a double binding, so combined to lower levels of PSMA. And it is a different petimeter, copper-64, so we can image the next day to get more contrast. So that may be a little bit different, but for right now, they're a little bit more similar than different. And, you know, for the average practitioner, it's probably ordering a PSMA PET. And on the back end, maybe don't even know which tracer is going to be used. And I think that's okay for right now.
And I was in on your talk, Scott. I saw some curves that were overlapping in some of these studies in terms of their utility and what they've shown in phase 3 studies. I mean, what just a high-level overview, where are they being used, where are they approved, and are they showing meaningful benefits? And if so, what are those benefits look like?
So for the diagnostics, I would say that the initial kind of no-brainer situation was biochemical recurrence, meaning they have surgery and or radiation, PSA is going up, don't really see anything. Where can we localize the source of that? So that was kind of the biggest no-brainer situation. Clearly has led to treatment changes. We don't know yet if there's a survival difference, but that was kind of the biggest no-brainer. And then, especially in higher risk disease, just initial staging. And it doesn't matter what the cancer is, at least for solid tumors. We want to know, is it in an area that we can take out with a knife or with radiation, or is it spread? And we can see smaller volume spread with the PET agent. So those are the two initial areas. And then the third is, as we kind of talked about, tied to the therapy. So in assessing for PSMA targeted radionuclide therapy, that's the other approved version. We're looking into assessment in serially, assessment for response, because we have the problem in prostate cancer of bone scans. They get brighter. Is that good? Is that bad? there's Flare. We don't really know where PSMA PET might be quantitative, but that hasn't been quite validated yet.
Okay. And in terms of these agents and managing toxicities, what are the toxicity signals here that you have to look out for? And are there dose modifications or adjustments based on it? What do everyday clinicians, practitioners need to be mindful of when they're using these drugs?
So just sticking with imaging agents, don't carry a lot of toxicity, but there's not zero. There have been some low-grade adverse events that have been reported in some of those registration studies. But I think what you're talking about is the therapy. Right. So I think the therapy adverse events are related to two parts. One is the radiation payload, if you will, and one is the sites. So with radiation, just being in the body, there may be some fatigue, and that's an AE that's relatively common. And then flowing through the bone marrow or landing in a tumor that's next to some stem cells may lead to some bystander effect with myelosuppression. Luckily, it's usually low grade and reversible, but it, like with other therapies, it can be high grade in long term. And then related to areas of PSMA expression, at least the small molecules, they'll carry whatever's on it to areas of PSMA expression, which are the salivary glands, so dry mouth or change in taste, lacrimal glands, dry eye, small intestine, so nausea, vomiting, constipation, diarrhea. And then the other one, which I think is important but luckily hasn't showed a signal yet, is the kidney. So all the small molecules are excreted through the kidney, but in addition, there's expression of PSMA in the proximal tubules, so we need to be mindful that years down the line, there may be an issue we need to monitor.
Okay, that's a great overview. In terms of other cell surface markers out there outside of PSMA, that are being looked at or show promise. Your thoughts on this?
So I think that this could be across the board. I know you said besides PSMA. So PSMA is of interest maybe for other solid tumors because of the expression in neovascular, which is probably 80-90% of other solid tumors. But in terms of prostate cancer, I would kind of divide it in the PSMA world that tends to be the AR positive, and there are other targets of interest such as TROP2, B7H3, and a laundry list of others that I think are of interest in that kind of group. And especially of interest are those that are what we might term neuroendocrine or AR low or aggressive variants, where PSA, PSMA might be low, but there are other areas of interest, and you well know DLL3, which is not so common in adenocarcinoid prostate, but more common in neuroendocrine prostate cancer, maybe 4 in 5 at a much higher rate. CEACAM5, not so common in adeno, but with the neuroendocrine. So there's other, depending on what happens with treatment resistance.
Okay. A lot of excitement here with some of the biomarkers. I mean, in lung, we are also desperately looking for things outside of PD-L1 and the genomic alterations. And IHC is front and center in a lot of the new scientific efforts. And always interested to learn other tumor types. Learned a tremendous amount about breast cancer earlier today. Let's switch gears into a topic that is also quite relevant in lung, which is the role of ctDNA. In lung, I will say that it has completely altered the diagnostic algorithm for our patients. The running joke for us is that it's sometimes hard to find a good interventional radiologist or pulmonologist, but everybody knows a good phlebotomist. And it is quite easy to tap into that rich, resourceful, usable blood to interrogate genomic alterations and make treatment decisions. How do you see this unfolding for patients, best practices for ctDNA testing, optimal timing, patient population? Where is this going in the GU world?
So I'd say kind of two kind of buckets of use. One is, I think what you're alluding to is assessment of either prognostic information or maybe predictable information in terms of assessing targets that are there. It's not to say less targets, because there's a lot of targets that are there, but less kind of validated targets. We have less kind of AR positive and negative main kind of buckets of disease. But certainly when we want to assess for something like HRD, BRCA, as an example, that is something that is often found in plasma. So that is looking for those types of things, I think, are a good use. We talked about bone in terms of bone scans before. But interventional radiology, the average interventional radiologist is going to be able to get almost any lymph node. But bone can be a little
tough,
more difficult after the centers, and you have to process the tissue. So in terms of timing, not at a time looking for targets at optimal response, at progression, and maybe as there's a sense PSA is going up, maybe we're going to need a new line of therapy at that particular time, particularly when we're looking for things that might change with therapy. There's also the quantification, which, like PSA, has been out there, so decreasing that a lot because of PSA, it hasn't worked out as well so far for prostate cancer. But it, you know, PSA is also downstream of AR, so you know, having something have to do with quantity of cancer, the ctDNA fraction might kind of wield it there. And then in terms of minimal residual disease, because of PSA, we haven't fully looked at that in prostate cancer, but in urothelial cancer, it's now really becoming prime time.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You know, we were joking before we got on here about circulating tumor cells and how that used to be the hot topic, not only in prostate cancer, it used to be the hot topic in lung cancer too for a while. Obviously, things have moved on to circulating tumor DNA, a little bit more sensitive assay, a little bit more accurate, a little bit more informative, I think, at least in lung. MRD, this came up in the breast cancer discussion we had, and you mentioned urothelial. You know, where do we see MRD? It seems like in prostate cancer, at least PSA has just kind of been around and can be used. Where is this going in these, like in kidney cancer and urothelial cancers? Is this something that you think you'll be able to use? And I will just parenthetically give you my answer through the lens of lung cancer, which is, I don't know what to do with that information for a patient who's cured, who I'm following with scans, and I get a ctDNA, and it's something pops up. If the scan is negative, I'm questioning how am I gonna leverage that information to make a treatment decision at that time with the patient. What's the discussion look like, or what does the science look like for kidney cancer, urothelial cancers, for MRD, for ctDNA, or is there a discussion still?
Yeah, in the world of GU, I would say it really is urothelial at this point. Prostate cancer has PSA, kidney cancer may not shed as much DNA. There's microRNA for germ cell tumors, but there's also looking into ctDNA. I would say probably something that is not different regardless of disease, particularly when there's, you know, a sensitive kind of bespoke looking at the tumor and kind of a platform becomes positive, scan. I think that's kind of a universal if they haven't had a scan. If the scan is negative, and what we now know from a study, it's called IMvigor011, which was presented at ESMO, is in the setting, if they haven't received any adjuvant IO, and it's within the first year, the scan is negative, they would benefit from atezolizumab. That's currently off-label, but that was the way the study was done. It's based on 010, which was negative, but retrospectively looking at ctDNA, maybe that's going to be both a prognostic and maybe a predictive biomarker, and as it turns out, it looked like it was. So surgery that was high risk, at least, you know, following neoadjuvant or not, negative DNA, observe. If it became positive within the first year, then they're randomized to atezolizumab versus not, and there was a benefit, both disease-free and overall survival benefit. So that there now is level one evidence in that specific setting.
And would that be something that you do in all of your patients based on that level one evidence? You're ordering that?
So much more now. So I was doing it some of the time before. Now, okay. Now, much more. You know, there's different issues. One is now if we're doing surgery, the preoperative regimen may be different. So an ADC plus IO, does that still hold? Because at least that data includes automatically postoperative data. So, and there's some that will have negative ctDNA that still probably benefit from the additional post-op regimen because it wasn't designed, those regimens weren't designed to answer questions. So I think in a selective patient population that had nothing or just kind of chemotherapy neoadjuvantly, I think it can be helpful. It's confusing as, you know, happens in lung cancer too, or maybe even more lung cancer. Luckily, the science is kind of going faster than the standard care, so we don't know what to kind of do with that.
Well, I'm actually jealous. I mean, that's the study that we need too in lung, is how can MRD guide a therapeutic decision making in the adjuvant setting that will lead to survival advantages? Sounds like you have that. We don't have that yet, and I think we're still struggling again with, given how front and center, ctDNA is in lung cancer, we still don't have that data as to how to really leverage that information. We have the data in the front line for an advanced stage patient. You know, we know that blood is truth, I tell my fellows. If it's there, you use that information. We don't wait for tissue at all. In prostate cancer, just going back, this is not something you would routinely do in the, and pardon my naivete on this, in the front line. This is something that you would do more for monitoring assessment of a particular therapy for ctDNA.
You said in prostate cancer?
Yeah, in prostate cancer.
No, I think it can be used for treatment decisions. So there is a study in the frontline setting in HRD that looks, it was ADT plus abiraterone and prednisone versus ADT, abiraterone and prednisone plus niraparib. So if someone, particularly if it's BRCA2, had that, currently it's off-label, and we'll see what happens in terms of FDA, but there's level one evidence that there's going to be a progression-free survival benefit and a trend for OS. So for those, you know, especially if it happens to be germline BRCA2, so those that we think have the biggest benefit, you know, it's not FDA-approved, currently it's off-label, but it likely was going to be, and I think it's a reasonable discussion right now, it probably is going to go into guidelines. For some of the other ones, it's you know, more unknown, and I guess it's probably true in lung cancer too, but prostate cancer is a big population for clonal hematopoiesis. Yeah. It's an older male population than that exists. So something like ATM, right, we have to be mindful of
yeah,
that as
the
well.
CHIP alterations, I think, are something that always need to be out there, just to be mindful of these genomic alterations found in white blood cells that may be in an older population that aren't necessarily related to the tumor. And I think that's really important to mention. Let's switch gears and talk a little bit about the current state of combination strategies in advanced clear cell renal cell carcinoma. Was able to attend that talk as well. Lots of competing options here. I've had to learn this personally through a family member recently as well. And it just seems like we're doing a lot of cross-trial comparisons. And again, correct me where I'm wrong here. There seems to be dual checkpoint blockade or IO-IO combinations and then these IO-TKI combinations or TKI alone for a less fit patient. You know, very high level and maybe 5 minutes. Like, can you just go through maybe the four categories? Are there four categories of sort of treatment options in the front line? Maybe more? I'm going off the slide that I saw, but like, what, just briefly, you know, what the, where are we with the data and how do you make a selection? Which is, I know, an unfair question to answer in 5 minutes. But.
Yeah, well, let me start off with the smaller buckets. So someone with delayed recurrent disease, small volume asymptomatic, observation or local therapy. Yeah. That's a small subset, but I think an important subset. I don't see so many of those with that are, I would consider right for a single agent, but you know, something that we want to treat that is not right, but that's also another small bucket. Not that IO has zero toxicity, but you know, maybe especially bigger for someone who has active autoimmune disease or something like that. Otherwise, the general standard, and this is, you know, most validated in clear cell or clear cell component, because that's how the trials were designed. But now data in non-clear cell, path layer, which is the most common, it generally is going to be an IO agent, PD-1 or PD-L1, with something else. And that something else could be CTLA-4 or it could be a multi-targeted VEGF TKI with no direct real head-to-head data. And, you know, I think the way that most of us in practice would select one versus the other would be that someone that is symptomatic, particularly in a worrisome location that needs a response within weeks, most of us, I think, would go with IO plus VEGF TKI because the rate of response might be faster. Though otherwise, I think, particularly in intermediate and high-risk disease, based on clinical factors, go with double IO. I think it's more likely we're going to be able to stop everything in that situation. So just chronic grade 1 with the VEGF over time, you know, the biases for that. It's not necessarily fair that we'd say there's more CRs with the double IO because it started earlier and some controversy. But anyway, I think that's how most of us would come in. The other thing that I think is important is that I think kidney cancer is the only disease that we have this, is that reinstituting PD-1 or PD-L1 is not worth it. So the initial data came out and that it was, you know, a PD-L1 as the next line of therapy. Okay, we poo-pooed it and said, okay, we still want to give another line of IO. And then the Teneva came out and it was PD-1 and there was an insert, there could be an insert of another drug, and still there's no benefit from reinstituting a PD-L1. If it's stopped at a certain time point and then growth, that's different. But if someone came off for progression in the metastatic setting, generally speaking, kidney cancer is the only level one evidence I think we have that we should not use it again.
Got it. Is there any role for not using IO and just single agent TKIs? I mean, is there a patient population where you would consider that for, or is it generally IO is a part of the treatment strategy for most, if not all, of your patients?
It is essentially, it's all. There's exceptions. It's not so different if we think about prostate cancer. It's going to be ADT plus an ARPI for essentially all, but occasional patients might get, it's similar, you know, autoimmune disease is something that might weigh in. I suppose sometimes it's access or cost or anything else, but hopefully in this country it's not going to be that. There was a big trial presented at ESMO that showed that they're not available here, but in a Chinese version of PD-1 plus VEGF was better than VEGF in the second line setting. And what did they have before? It was sunitinib and pazopanib, very like our data 10 years ago. So if they don't have access, you know, that's a little bit different story. But almost everyone that can, and I think most people can, probably should get IO.
We talked a lot about clear cell. What about non-clear cell? Is it the same? Pretty much, are we doing the same thing we did in small? We're sort of taking the data from non-small cell and applying it to small cell. Is it similar that you're just using that data and applying it, or is the biology different enough that you have to think completely differently about it?
So I guess the former or the latter is the very short answer. So historically, we'd said immunotherapy doesn't work in non-clear cell. We have to think historic was cytokines, and interferon IL-2 didn't work really that well outside of clear cell. Fast forward, there might, in answer to your question, there might be some biology with subsets of papillary that might be MET-driven, et cetera. But overall, what it looks like is that they respond to the same drugs. So with the PD-1 and PD-L1s, they actually can respond. So, you know, we don't have randomized phase 3 data at this point, but, you know, there's pretty good data that IO plus VEGF will work in the non-clear cell subsets with, you know, papillary is the most common, followed by chromophobe, but there's data for those.
Okay. Interesting to see very similar themes resonate across different tumor types with how data is applied to different subsets of patients within that tumor type. We've got about 5 to 10 minutes left here. Last question before I get to my my game. What are you most excited to see over the next 12 months? And what I did for breast cancer is what I'd say is there's probably a lot of stuff. Put your nickel down on one thing that you're really looking forward to in the next 12 months.
Do I get one per disease?
Yes, you get one per disease. You do.
So I'll start with urothelial because it's actually already happening. But moving some of these drugs that have survival advantages in the metastatic setting in the PRP setting. So survival advantages, but those survival advantages equal cure. So we've moved those into earlier settings, and we've already increased the cure rate. It's confusing because there are different options, chemo IO plus ADC IO, but it's very clear to me that we've increased the cure rate, and now we just need to work on patient selection. Hopefully we'll have some biomarkers to kind of help us with that. So I'm very excited about that transition from metastatic disease to early disease, and more trials to come that will, I think, shift again the paradigm. I don't know what to do if they recur now, but it's okay problem to kind of have. In prostate cancer, similar, but I'm looking at what has already happened in 2025, 3 phase 3 trials in the first line setting. Someone walking in the door with metastatic disease, biomarker selected, that we now can pick something that we can add to that backbone of ADT and ARPI. And at least so far what we have for all of them is at least a progression-free survival benefit with transfer OS. So we'll see what happens. But now that we have chemo that's always there, and we don't actually technically know that chemo adds to that. That's a cooperative group trial, enroll in Inspire.
nice plug.
But, yeah. You know, now we have some molecular selected agents. And there's some overlap in the molecular selection, But that's okay. We have some patient choices, and not everyone is right for all of these things. Just so it's par politician PSMA-617 and AKT is this kind of what's out there. So it's I like that because it's now at diagnosis for metastatic disease, and if we can keep them in that first line setting for longer, we know in all diseases, less get second line and third line, et cetera. So if we can maximize the first line, then that's even better. For kidney cancer, I guess it's what I'm most excited about is what I've seen only in press release so far. So we've had a number of adjuvant trials over the years. Almost all have been negative. We had a semi-positive SNITNA trial. And then one of the IO trials was positive. And we had another. So Durvalumab was positive, Rampart at ESMO. I'm not sure how much it's going to change practice, but at least validated IO in that post-op setting. Now there's another one that adds to Pembro. So adding the HIF inhibitor, belzutifan, to that. We haven't seen the data, but mechanistically it makes absolute sense in clear cell. And we know that by press releases of disease for survival. So another way to increase cures that are there. That drug is also looks like it's moving up into the second line metastatic setting as well. So I'm also excited about that. But anytime we increase the cure rate, that's even better.
Yeah, a lot of exciting data. It's funny, we have a game in lung conferences where we do an over-under on how many slides will be press release slides only, because it seems like there's so much press release without data. And there's usually like six. I mean, if you pick six, that's pretty good. That the over is, you know, over-under is around six, and that's what we see in a full day of lung cancer slides, given how much data that there is out there that we're not seeing yet, but certainly looks like the signals are there and the press release is there. Thank you for watching this segment discussing all things GU malignancies on Onc Live on air here at our CFS event.